Welcome to the conference call of a.s.r. on its half-year results 2014. The call will be hosted by Chris Figee, CFO of a.s.r., and Jack Julliger, CIO, Financial Markets. At this moment, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be opportunity to ask questions. I would like to hand over the conference to Mr. Figee. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Chris Figee and Jack Julliger from a.s.r. Welcome to this conference call. In this rainy and cloudy August, we'd like to add some sunshine to your life by presenting the a.s.r. half-year results. I'm Chris Figee. I joined this group May 1st. Next to me is Jack Julliger, Chief Investment Officer and Head of Financial Markets. We have not yet met in person, and I do hope to meet all of you soon in person in the near future. But in the meantime, let us walk you through the half-year results by a.s.r. and then open the floor for any questions that you may have. I would like to ask you to move in the presentation that was submitted to page three with the key messages. If you'd be in this room physically with me, you'd be looking at a pleased and proud CFO because these are the numbers that, as a new CFO, you'd like to start with, you'd like to present in your first half-year presentation. Net result up to 161 million, up from 110 million last year. And if you exclude last year additional VGA provisioning or abnormal provisioning, it was up 8%. Solvency at 284% as per the end of June. What pleases most is that the improvement in result was really predominantly due to improvement in underwriting results. So the group has set a course in terms of returning to the core of its business, insuring customers against claims, insuring customers against adverse developments, and that is starting to pay off. The results are up and solvency is up mainly because of underwriting results and lower costs. Our costs are declining for the sixth consecutive year. With that performance, we believe we are solidly on track for future and forthcoming privatization. When you move to the next page, it says a.s.r.'s sustainable strategy is bearing fruit. We believe that the results we're presenting are the consequence of the result of a dedicated and determined course of action, where the group increasingly focuses on customer needs. By innovating and improving our products and services whilst being firmly rooted in society. In terms of customer needs, we focus on prevention and rehabilitation and integration. We focus on complaints handling and good, and we do get good grades and good rewards for that. Work on innovating new products. We mentioned a few: the employee pension plan, which is an innovative DC plan for the SME community, or the mortgage with adjustable rates when consumers pay down their balance, and a contribution to society, for example, by our Fighting Cancer campaign, or the fact that the Fair Insurance Guide has ranked a.s.r. number one when it comes to sustainable and responsible investments. So underlying our results, underlying the financials, is a dedicated strategy around customer needs, back to our core, innovating products and services whilst making a contribution to society. Helping by doing is our motto and is increasingly underpinned and underlined. Then the financials on page number five. As you can see, the result up from 110 million to 161 million, plus 8% if you exclude the VGA provision of last year. Premiums stable to down a bit, which you can break down in stable to increasing premiums in a non-life business and a life business that declines, but declines in line with the market. So an expected and forecasted decline of the life business leads to well-behaving total premium levels. Operating expenses down 3% in spite of investments in new initiatives and a decline for the sixth consecutive year, in line with the gradual decrease of the internal workforce. So a step-by-step gradual improvement in productivity of the group. That leads to an ROE of 12.3%. Honestly, requires me to say it's a bit flattered because the IAS 19 impact, which we'll talk about later, Underlying ROE is around 11.2, headline figure 12.3, but regarded 11.2 or 12.3, we feel is a very strong and healthy return equity number. And a solvency ratio, as we said, up from 268 to 284%, as per DNB definitions. Page 6 shows you the bridge, the development from last year, 2013, to first half of 2014. As you can see, the increase in result driven by non-life, 84 million in non-life, consisting of 39 million, no additional expense for Via Vegia, and 45 real underlying improvement in combined operating ratios. Life business roughly stable, and a segment other, which really is an amalgamation of a number of activities that are not core to the insurance business, is down by 32 million, which we'll talk about it later. Generally speaking, we believe that the delta in result really was driven by an improved underwriting result, which you can see from the 84 million improvement in non-life. The combined ratios are now below 100% for really all our non-life businesses. Page 7 shows the cost development on a multi-year basis. It's something that we're proud of. The group has invested in a lot. I think the cost discipline and cost containment is by now rooted in the DNA of the group. We have a gradual and consistent decline in cost rates. Whether it's the full-year cost or the half-year cost, they continue to decline. And also this year, in the first half-year, we realized a 3% decline in cost versus the same period in last year. Whilst we continue to invest in a number of new initiatives in IT and in distribution, and in line with that, our workforce is declining as well to little over 3,600 FTEs. So continued staff reduction, continued productivity improvement, underpinning a gradual and consistent decline in costs. Now through our business lines, to start with non-life on page number 8, where you can see again the results, up to 90 million in the first half year. Premium levels stable to up a bit. If you double click on that, you'll see a disability is up 519 to 544. Health premiums up because we gained 550,000 new health customers in last year's health campaign, as we call it, and P&C down a bit because of our drive to push for value over volume. The integrated combined ratio of the non-life business from 104 to 93.7, a substantial decline. And if you look at the individual business lines on the right-hand side, you can see the decline and improvement in combined ratio across the board. Disability to 94, health stable at around 98, and P&C down 10 percentage points from 100 to 90%. With that latter point on P&C, that's a fantastic improvement. Honestly, required to tell you, we've had our wind in our sails due to the benign winter. As you recall, the winter was quite soft. We did have very little large fires, so the large claims, large fires, we definitely outperformed last year and even outperformed our own expectations. And when it comes to larger claims and larger fires, we believe the trend is in the right direction. The trend seems to be a result of real initiatives, but it will take a longer period of time to really assess whether this is sustainable or not. I would assume that after 10 percentage points decline in the P&C combined ratio, about 5 to 6 percentage points is some tailwind, and 2 to 3% is really about improvement in prevention, improvement in claims handling, and which we see reflected in a lower claims frequency, and the remainder is lower cost and improvement in the other segment. So a good performance in P&C. We believe our combined ratio in P&C is very strong, also when you compare it to the rest of the market. But honestly, tells me that we've had some benefit of benign weather next to a structural improvement that shows into sustainably lower claims frequency levels. When we go to our life business, the life result is stable at 164 million in the first half year, despite a decline in the market. The decline in premium levels from 1 billion to 900 million. Is actually in line with what we've seen in the past, what we expected. The decline is a result of the expiration of policies that you can safely predict and safely track. The incidental or unexpected lapses have gone down to only 1.7%. Really, this is a decline in line with the maturity of the portfolio. Production up from 19 to 28. Two-thirds of that production is in the pension business. One-third is in the life and funeral business. That's up versus last year. We believe full year we're on track to meet the entire production of last year. There's been some shift in seasonal patterns by our customers, where in last year the new production in life shifted from H1 to H2. This year that seems to be normalized. So it's up against last year. For the full year, we believe to be stable to last year. Cost ratio down. This chart shows the cost ratio, cost over APE, from 9.3 to 8.6. And if we were to measure cost ratio over the premium levels, over gross written premium, it would also be down, respectively, from 8.1 to 7.5, which provide me some comfort that in spite of the declining life book, we're able to reduce our cost faster than the book shrinks, and thereby gradually reducing the cost per policy. So that means an adequate response to the predictable yet unavoidable decline in the life book, with the results stable at 164 million. The segment other, page 10. The segment other really is the amalgamation of a number of activities that are not linked to insuring customers. It contains our bank, our mortgage production factory, an emergency desk, our real estate development, and a number of holding companies. The results of other went from minus 61 to minus 93 due to a number of reasons. One is the pension charges for the group went up a bit because that's booked at holdco level at the other level, and the pension charges went up due to lower interest rates. We did book a number of additional provisions, some of them for the implementation of SEPA, a new payment center, payment systems, where we were conservatively estimating that this might lead to some different payment patterns by clients. We made some reservation for that, and we made additional provisions for a few projects in the property development area. And finally, we incurred additional costs with regard to investment into new initiatives and with regard to the potential future privatization of the group. That together explains the drive from 61 to 93 million negative in the segment other. The bank, ASR Bank, is successful at growing deposits. The mission of the bank is to retain expiring life policies. Retention ratios are now around 20%, and with a positive trend, which is where we want them to be, and we think they should be, and that we think there's scope for increase in the future. We sold new mortgages about a little over 500 million, of which the majority is 80% is government guaranteed. With regards to the property development business, that is gradually and consistently scaled down. The drop in total assets of this activity, the total balance sheet, dropped from 200 to 173 million in line with what we're trying to achieve. So that leads to, from our side, a solid set of results driven by improved underwriting performance and a sustainable and continued decline in costs. When it comes to our solvency, solvency remains strong. That could be actually a euphemism at 284% DNB solvency, up from 268 last year. Sensitivity is roughly stable. And what I like about this number is that the capitalization of the group is of high quality. There's very little dependency on hybrid instruments. It's really 80% of our equity is hard common equity. Equity was affected by the IAS 19 pension obligation, where the decrease in interest rate and the accounting treatment, or we call the accounting treatment of our pension liabilities, cost a negative development in our equity of 462 million. But that is not part of our solvency calculation. It's really an accounting phenomenon. So solvency up to 284%. Equity still includes a 782 million of unrealized gains for real estate. With that, I'd like to hand the floor to Jacques to talk us through the investment portfolio and the investment performance. Jacques.
Thank you, Chris. When we turn to sheet number 12, an overview is given of our investment portfolio. In the first half year of 2014, the composition of our investment portfolio remained stable, and we further optimized the risk profile. key of our investment policy is to safeguard a solid financial position, and we realized a satisfying performance in a low-yield environment. Interest rates and spreads dropped substantially to the lowest levels ever, and we operated in an environment of low economic growth, broad monetary conditions, and low inflation and even deflationary tendencies. In this low-rate environment, there was regained trust and confidence in credit markets, and we saw a return of investors to the credit markets. The biggest challenge in such an environment is to keep the running yield on the portfolio as high as possible and to prevent it from declining quickly. In line with this development, we increased the exposure to residential mortgages and invested in French sovereigns and made a limited investment in peripheral government bonds. Real estate exposure was kept stable, and we decreased exposure to equities. Transactions in our equity portfolio were mainly aimed at further regional diversification. In summary, we maintained a solid investment portfolio that supported the strong financial performance, and we further optimized the risk profile. The next sheet gives more details of the fixed income portfolio. The fixed income portfolio showed a relatively strong performance due to lower interest rates and tightening of spreads. The larger part of the government portfolio is invested in Dutch and German sovereigns. For the first time since the beginning of the credit crisis, there were no fixed income impairments. The return was positively impacted by some reversals of impairments of financials and structured investments. We took advantage of illiquidity premiums by investing in French government bonds in peripheral countries like Spain, Italy, and Ireland, and we increased investments in corporate bonds and also allocated a budget for hybrid corporates. We continued our policy of selectively reducing our exposure to financials by divesting Tier 1 bonds. And furthermore, we optimized the financial portfolio by implementing a barbell strategy, where we divested senior bonds and invested in a combination of higher yielding covered bonds and lower Tier 2 bonds. As a consequence of the strong appetite of investors for subordinated financial debt, the financial portfolio showed a strong performance. The value of the derivatives portfolio increased due to lower interest rates, and as you know, we use derivatives solely for managing the interest rate risk and to immunize the balance sheet for movements in interest rates. We continue to further optimize the interest rate hedge by shifting from 15-year swaps to 30-year swaps to improve the hedge to non-parallel shift of the yield curve. And according to the introduction of EMIR rules, we selected clearing members and a trade repository and also finished all preparations for central clearing. We can conclude that there was a controlled movement to less liquid, higher yielding assets, and that contributes to the running yield. And furthermore, the fixed income portfolio remained of high quality. When we turn to page number 15, an overview is given of the mortgage portfolio, and more details are given of the equity exposure. My apologies. When we turn to sheet number 40. Chris explained that ASR realized 553 million of new production through the Weltthuis lane in mortgages. Our market share decreased from 4% to 2.4%, and that was due to the decision to maintain margins at a minimum level in an environment of decreasing rates. The new production is almost fully underwritten with NHG, equal to government guarantee. We continued our policy of increasing the exposure to residential mortgages, and that illustrates the controlled shift to less liquid but higher yielding assets. And also the solvency treatment under Solvency II is relatively attractive. The portfolio of residential mortgages remained of outstanding quality, with almost 90% guaranteed by NHG, or with a value of more than less than 100% of the loan to foreclosure value. And when you take into account that the foreclosure value equals 90% of the actual value of the property, that underscribes the value of the portfolio. And that underscribes the quality of the portfolio. The value of the equity portfolio went down in line with the strategic asset allocation study. Divestments were made in over 5% participations and in emerging markets. And also there was a release of seed capital in our next generation mix funds that are reported under other funds. Transactions in the equity portfolio were mainly aimed at regional diversification. And in that context, we invested in Swiss and UK large corporates. We pursued our policy of hedging downward risk on the less liquid part of the equity portfolio. In case of the 5% participations and the equity investments in the separated accounts by a put option strategy. We can conclude that we continued with a controlled increase of our residential mortgage portfolio, and furthermore, we decreased the exposure to equities and continued the downside protection. Sheet number 15 gives more details on the real estate portfolio. Our policy in real estate was that we made no new investments in commercial real estate, except redevelopments, property in own use, and a small increase in rural real estate. Sales were mainly concentrated in the residential portfolio and the retail portfolio. Again, we were able to sell participations in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund to a high-quality institutional investor on behalf of a Dutch pension fund. The remaining stake of ASR in the Dutch Prime Retail Fund is 55%. A vulnerable segment of the real estate market is still the market for commercial offices. The exposure to commercial offices is, with less than 10% relative, limited. The real estate portfolio overall proved to be resilient in difficult market circumstances. And that underscribes the high quality of the portfolios. And the impairments in the portfolio were very limited. The increase offices own use reflects the refurbishment and the progress of the refurbishment of our office in Utrecht. That proceeds according to plan and will lead to a cost-efficient office building that complies with the highest environmental and sustainability standards. Real estate exposure is concentrated in the Dutch market. 35% of the portfolio is in rural real estate, 25% in residential properties, and 24% in retail. Fair value determination is a result of a very strict valuation process. All premises are evaluated every year by external valuators, and there's a quarterly internal check at every 3 years. There's a tender for the valuation assignment. Vacancy rates of offices and retail properties went up moderately. For retail, that is due to temporary frictional vacancy. For offices, the reason is that offices on use are reallocated for commercial use due to our policy of centralizing housing, mainly in Utrecht. To summarize, no new investments in commercial real estate were done, and the portfolio proved to be very stable in difficult market circumstances. That brings me to the overall conclusion. Key of our investment policy is that we further optimized our asset base, supporting the outstanding financial result in the first half year. We maintained a solid investment portfolio, and we further optimized the risk profile. The optimization of the asset base was realized by a controlled movement in the fixed income portfolio to less liquid, higher yielding assets, the continuation of the policy of a controlled increase in the exposure to higher yielding residential mortgages, a lower exposure to equities, and the continuation of our policy of downward protection, and no new investments in commercial real estate. That concludes my presentation. Chris, I would like to hand over to you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Jacques. Before we go into the questions, I'd like to point to the final page with the key messages to close off our presentation. The three numbers to remember are 161, which is the net result, solvency at 284, and then anything below 100, which reflects our combined ratios. We believe that provides a healthy and satisfactory set of results. And as you're aware, people in the insurance industry tend to be reserved and balanced in nature, so the word satisfactory is actually quite a modest statement. What I like about the results is that it is driven by an improvement in underwriting results. The contribution from investment returns actually stable versus last year across all business lines. It's really the delta in underwriting result that improved the business, although we did have some tailwind from the benign weather in the first half of the year. With that, I think the group is comfortably and solidly on track for any future privatization developments. And with that, I'd like to close off our presentation and open the floor to questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will start the question and answer session now. To be registered for the question and answer queue, please press star 1. Your questions will be answered in the order that they are received. If you have a question, please press star 1. First question is from Cor Kluis, Rabobank. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Cor Kluis, Rabobank. I've got a few questions. First of all, on the life results, the pre-tax profit was 211 million euros. My question is, what was the amount of capital gains, impairments, and releases in this figure? If you could highlight that. In the presentation, you indicate positive impairment reversals on financial bonds, for example, so that's a plus, but can you highlight those parts? That's my first question. Second question is about the ultimate forward rate. I understand that you don't disclose that actively like you did in the annual report anymore, but at least could you give an indication of the 284%, which part of that is the ultimate forward, due to the ultimate forward rate? I would estimate around 60%. Could you highlight that one? My third question is about your own pension fund. It was quite a material minus in the first half of this year. Could you indicate what you want to do with this going forward? You've seen a few other financial companies have putting their pension fund separate from the company. Do you consider something like that, or would you like to hedge that more for interest rate risk, which you've been doing very well for your life insurance operations? So that were my three questions.
Thank you very much. As to your first question on the results on the life business, a few broader remarks on the group. As I mentioned, the group investment contribution has been stable. We do not yet publish an official underlying results. We do have to develop a prototype of that internally, which we're testing, and at some point we'll be publishing externally. But that will give indication, if you normalize the result of the group, the net income for the last year would still be up by over 20% on a normalized basis. That's one important thing to stress. If you look at the life business, there were the real capital gains of the life business, such were a bit less than last year. The reversal impairments were higher. I think that if you specifically look to the capital reversal impairments line, that line item of the line business, that was at about a little over 30, 35 million versus last year. More information actually is in the segmented income statement of our report. But the most important thing for me is realized capital gains a bit less than last year, impairment reversals a bit higher than last year, and on the group level, total contribution from the investment side stable. When it comes to the UFR, we don't officially disclose. Your estimate of 60% is reasonably accurate. It actually is 50. So excluding the UFR, the Solvency one would be around 233%.
Okay.
When it comes to our IAS 19 pension developments, this is quite a peculiar phenomenon, as you're aware, because in IAS 19, it stipulates that this part of your pension obligation should be valued at market value with a very specific high-quality corporate bond curve where the rest of your balance sheet is you know, accounted for on mostly nominal value. That leads, as you are, to unexpected or large deltas in your equity. What we've experienced that due to the drop in interest rates and especially the compression of spreads in the very long end of the curve, and now I'm getting into technicalities, the discount rate for the pension liabilities dropped quite significantly, leading to a deduction from equity. What we're doing to respond to this is a few things. One is, this is an accounting phenomenon, so it used an accounting solution. So we're looking whether our current methodology embeds or contains too large volatility or more volatility than other players have in this field. Secondly, as a group, we are looking at our pension liability and our inflation commitments. That's something that's high on the agenda for next half year. Too early to give any further announcement at this point in time. So we see this as an accounting phenomenon that requires an accounting solution. It does not affect our solvency, so it's purely a presentation matter. And the solution of this part should be found in looking whether our valuation methodology is in line with the universe of data points that's out there. And secondly, when it comes to hedging, we hedge our business using economic curves, we hedge our business using an ECAP model, and we just continue to do that irrespective of the IAS 19 accounting provision.
Okay, very clear. Thanks.
Next question is from David Andrich, Morgan Stanley. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my questions. I just had two questions. First of all, on Solvency II, I was just wondering, some of your peers have talked about a little bit of a shift towards more of a standardized approach in terms of using a standard model in the Netherlands as opposed to internal models. And I was just wondering if you could maybe give a little bit of color on that and or some of the other discussions that are, you know, more Dutch-specific in regards to Solvency II. Additionally, I was just wondering maybe if you could just walk us through some of the steps that are still to come in terms of your preparation for privatization and maybe some timelines around that. Thank you.
Yeah, on the first question concerning the movement to standard models, concerning our position is that we always optimized under the standard model. But we have also, for some of the risk categories, especially for the market risk bucket, we have some more sophisticated methods. We use there our ECAP model, and in that sense, we steer for internal purposes our portfolio and optimize our portfolio within the ECAP model. But on the other hand, we are aware of the fact that there's very much attention and very much importance paid to the standard model. So we focus on the standard model, but on the other hand, as we can use a more sophisticated approach, we also use ECAP model as we can optimize better than. Concerning steps, we are preparing for Solvency II. Well, we are prepared. We already operated and are steering our risks based and within our Solvency II environment. We do that for several years already. We feel that we are prepared for the next step, for the implementation of Solvency II. Of course, there are some issues that have to be investigated further. For example, the consequences of the volatility balancer, and also the possibilities of implementation of the matching adjustment. For example, in the field of immediate annuities and annuities, that is part of the regular process of our strategic balance, integral balance studies. So the conclusion is we are ready for Solvency II. We are on track with the preparation, and we are aware of the fact that there is more attention for the standard model.
Thank you.
David, when it comes to your second question around the privatization process, as you are aware, we're a state-owned insurer. Despite that we never received state support, we are owned by the state, and the Minister of Finance has expressed that, in principle, he pursues a dual track in order to bring us back into the private sector, which is either a trade sale or an IPO. With the announcement of the EC-driven sale of Real, that dual track has been postponed, and we've been granted the opportunity to potentially bid for the insurance activities of Real. And that process has been kicked off early July with the first announcement by Real. We are, as it's very serious and diligently contemplating whether we should invest in Real. We have seriously not made that decision yet. It's all work in progress. Could be the case, could be not. So we're doing our work to see if and how and to what extent we'd like to bid for the Real activities. At the same time, we are preparing the group for being ready to be IPO'd if and when needed, which is then translated into focus back on the insurance business, underwriting results rather than investment results, and enhancing our own reporting and analysis capability to make sure that when the IPO phase comes, we're ready to do that. At this point in time, the dual track is postponed up to the moment where the formal bidding process on Real will start, and that's something that we're working on and we're seriously contemplating.
Great. Thank you very much.
Next question is from Albert Ploeg, ING Bank. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Also a few questions from my side. First one, maybe follow up on the privatization process. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on how you could finance this? Can you use any spare hybrid capacity, or should it be fully equity funded, so to speak? And yeah, this clearly probably requires a third party. So that's the first question. The second one is, in the Netherlands, some new longevity tables will come out somewhere in the later half of this year. Do you already have any expectations in how you would potentially deal with this? Would you take a one-off provision if required, so, or will you provision it on a quarterly basis going forward, so to speak, in case it's unfavorable? And the third question is on capital generation. You already made some comments on the IGD ratio and the UFR impact. Is it possible maybe to get, let's say, an absolute figure in terms of how much capital has been generated purely operational, so excluding any market impacts? Those were my questions.
Okay. All right. Albert, thank you very much for your questions. As your first point on the specific how we look at the potential Real acquisitions from a financial and financing perspective, the group has sufficient hybrid capacity. Right? We have only a relatively small amount of hybrids outstanding, so if we wanted to, we could finance the transaction with sufficient amount of hybrid capacity. However, there's a couple of quid pro quos. Whatever we do will not harm or jeopardize the single A rating of the group. So it has to be done within the ranges of the single A rating. Secondly, it is our expectation that because this is a transparent process between two government-owned entities. If it were to happen, it needs to be a market conformance, market consistent test, which is easier done when it's funded with equity rather, with hard equity rather than hybrids. And thirdly, it depends very much on the valuation of Real. Depends very much on what we actually find when you start looking under the hood of the Real engines. So to make a long story short, I cannot give you any clarity on how we want to finance this, let alone we are sticking to a single A rating. And I believe that whatever we do, the transaction will be, if it happens, it will be predominantly financed by equity. And we're working with a number of potential investors to see if we can attract equity capital providers in this transaction. That is all I can say about it at this point in the process.
Okay.
When it comes to the longevity table, we feel relatively comfortable with that. It's not really clear when exactly the new table will come out. Economically, we run a fairly balanced mortality book because we do own a funeral business, we own a pension business, and we have traditional term life. So our book has a natural hedge against mortality shifts. If you went through our internal deliberations on embedded value, MCEV, we felt that parallel shifts in the longevity table actually have relatively limited impact on the market-consistent embedded value of the group. So we'll only see what the impact is when the numbers actually come out. But rest assured that, one, economically we run a fairly balanced book. Technically, the LAT, the liability adequacy test, shows significant amount of surplus. So we feel comfortable bearing unforeseen developments that any deltas in the mortality table should be well absorbed with the group. But I can really only tell you when the tables are out, but it does not cost me any sleepless nights, to be quite frank.
Okay.
When it comes to the underlying IGD capital generation, we moved up from 268 to 284. There are three elements that interplay and drive the delta in IGD. One is interest rate and market developments. Simply speaking, by deploying a UFR, lowering interest rate increases your solvency. Then there's the internal capital generation of the business. And there's the fact that we paid $99 million of dividends to the state, effectively to all of us, as part of the dividend to our shareholder. If you look at the net increase of 15%, 16% IGD, that is, roughly speaking, 12% positive from interest rate developments, 10% positive from retained earnings, and then you subtract 5 to 6% because of the dividend that was paid out, which gives us an excluding interest rate, an underlying IGD growth rate of about 1.6, 1.7% per month, at least in the last half year.
Okay, that's very helpful.
Next question is from Matthias De Witt, KBC Securities. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, and thanks for taking my questions. Just to follow on Solvency II, can you provide a bit more insight into the strength of ASR's capital position under Solvency II capital rules, maybe by providing an internal model-based Solvency II ratio? And could you also comment in this respect whether there's a big difference between internal model-based and standard formula-based Solvency II ratios? So that would be my first question. And secondly, wondered whether you could update us on your group pension strategy. Is it mainly focused on DC or also on DB and buyouts? And could you, in this respect, provide some comments on profitability of new business in both DC and DB? And then my last question is on the life business. Could you comment or provide some your view on how you expect earnings to develop going forward, considering that there are many moving parts, including the low interest rates, declining back book, but also the drop in the cost base. So any comments would be helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, key for our solvency is that we strive for a solid single A position, and that must be supported by the Solvency II metrics. We have, on the one hand, the standard model. We feel that we must be fairly away from the minimum of the SCR. We strive for, let's say, a minimum of 120%, but we want to be far away from that, and that is why we have an internal target that's up between 150% and 175% under the standard model.
Sorry to interrupt, that 150%-175%, how have you come up with that target? Is it a rating agency-based target, or is the regulator steering in that direction, or?
What you can say, we looked for the, let's say, the actual number, and we feel comfortable because we optimized in our integral balance studies the risks on the balance sheet. As the actual number is in that range, we feel comfortable with such a range in the standard model. Is that answering your question?
Yes, thank you.
Then concerning the internal model, because in our internal methodologies, we make a further refinement of the assessment of some of the different risk classes, especially at the market risk side. There we have somewhat higher targets. We strive there for a target that is in between, let's say, 175% and 200%. Is that answering your question?
Yes, thanks. That's very helpful.
Matthias, with regards to your second question on the pensions business and the life business, in our pension strategy, we increasingly focus on defined contribution solutions to our customers, where we believe we have a strength in the SME mid-corp space, where some of our new products actually find their way to customers and to the specialist advisors. When it comes to the DB business, does not have a priority for us, and especially in today's interest rate environment, this is quite it's a competitive market, let's say, and it's a capital-intensive market where you should always balance the risk versus the reward that you have. So our focus is on DC versus DB. Does not mean we're out of the DB market, but we're very selective in the clients that we pursue and the business that we pursue, and we certainly do not want to commit a large amount of risk capital against any large DB blocks.
If I can just follow up on that, is there, with regard to the capital intensity of DB, is there a big difference between Solvency I and Solvency II or risk-based capital requirement for that type of business?
That depends on how much market risk you wish to use to win the client's business. If you wish to deploy a high-risk investment portfolio or the customer demands significant guarantees, then you have to deploy market risk-heavy investment portfolio, which is charged much more heavily under Solvency II than under Solvency I. So it's more a function of the investment portfolio that requires to meet the guarantee levels that either client expects or that are prevalent in the market.
Okay.
And as we move from DB to DC, when it comes to business margins, the value of new business of the group is positive, yet slightly positive, which is fine with me in today's interest environment. I'd like to note that we do calculate VNB using the Solvency II MCEV curve, so we don't want to refer to curve changes to boost our VNB. We use the Solvency II MCEV curve. The VNB is positive, but it is challenging in these environments to write positive VNB business, so we tend to restrain ourselves when it comes to pursuing business as long as rates are what they are. And thirdly, we're not in the business of taking large interest rate bets with the business that we write, using shareholder or actually taxpayer money to write interest rate bets. So that's our strategy in life, or in pensions. When it comes to our life business, you asked, is the business declining or how do you see profits holding up? Well, in the long run, this book will run off. In the long run, this book will expire, and that's something that you can reasonably well predict. Whereas actually the provisioning level is holding up longer than the amount of number of policies. We believe in the coming years, the life profitability should be relatively stable because we do have a number of cost opportunities that we can go through where we believe we can reduce the cost per policy in line with or possibly even faster than the decline of the book. We believe the investment returns we should be able to keep up for now, although you know the longer and faster rates are going lower, the more difficult it becomes. But we believe for the coming years we should be able to hold up the life profits roughly in line with some bandwidth against the current number. In the longer term, that will decline, and all insurance companies need to find other sources of revenues.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Next question is from Michael van Wegen, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi guys. Good afternoon. Michael van Wegen, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. First of all, I wanted to go back to the question on the sale of Real. You mentioned that the first time deadline, I guess, is the official bidding process. Can you talk a little bit about how the timeline looks for Real if you were to decide to bid on it? When is sort of the first round of bidding, and when do you expect there should be an outcome of the bidding process? Second question, on the disability market, in the press release it's commented that you guys are now growing market share and comfortable with that. Can you talk about what price increases you've been putting through since, let's say, the bottom of the market, and why does that make you feel comfortable at this stage? Third question would be on Woekerpolis issues. Obviously, one of your big competitors that recently IPO'd has had not too clever headlines around this subject. Can you remind us about where you are with this? Are there any major cases against you managed by Stichtingen, and if so, what is kind of the timeline for any potential headlines on this? And the last question is on your running yield and new money yield. Can you talk a little bit about what is your running yield for the life book at this stage? And taking into account the somewhat re-risking that you talked about, what's the new money yield today? And are you comfortable with continuing this asset allocation for new money, or should we expect a more defensive reinvestment policy in the near future? Thank you.
Michael, thank you. Regards to your first question on the Real process and the timelines, you read Real issued a statement early July that's about to kick off this process. The process will take place in the autumn, which is relatively soon when it starts to really kick off. But first, I really think I should point you towards Real for questions around their process. It's not for me to comment on that. I think, not sure when the Real press conference is, but I think you have to wait for them, and I think you should ask that question to them. When it comes to the disability business, yes, our premium levels are up. What we're seeing there is an improvement in premium levels and improvement in results. Not so much from price increases, although we did increase prices on the Via VGA product, where we just restored or recovered pricing. We meant to more appropriate pricing. It was not that margin pricing, but more restoring pricing in line with claims and payment behaviors. And that pricing is in line with what other insurers have done. On the other parts of the VGA business, we did not increase our prices. Maybe on selective cases, really small segments, but generally the uplift really was about improving prevention, improving claim handling, and especially improving claims management, the reintegration of disabled clients back into the workforce. So the result in in disability is not driven by price increase, but it's driven by claims prevention, claims management, and reintegration, so claims handling and claims costs. As regards to the VUCA polis, we have made a provision in the past for the VUCA polis exposures. We have now dealt with basically all our customers in that arrangement. The open points is for any insurer as a self-callers and hardship cases, where there is a little bit more time for those to be worked out. But we're well and adequately provisioned for those cases and dealing with those customers. Second point, we're working hard on activating customers that have a unit-linked beleggingsverzekering, unit-linked policy. And activation means contacting these customers and asking, are you fully comfortable? What will you save? And are you aware of the alternatives? And do you want to switch? And could we help you potentially move to another product? Because you need to be aware of what you own. There we contacted, I think, a good 70% of all customers. And the majority of them have actually decided to yes or no take action, but made a conscious decision with regard to the VUCA polis. We have not received any major claims, any major other issues above and beyond what we have provided for. So we feel as confident as one can be with the situation. At least the current provisioning is adequate and is in line with what we promised to our customers. With regards to another question, I think Jacques, would you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that was your question on the expected running yield in the life book. When we look to the running yield on the total book, we are at a level of, let's say, 3.6%. And fixed income is somewhat lower, and, for example, mortgages and average are somewhat higher, is 4.4%. There's also an impact additionally of 0.2%, which can be attributed to the annual release of the technical provision shadow accounting. So on average, you can say that the running yield on the portfolio is somewhere at around 3.8%. Total yield, of course, if you also look to the unrealized revaluations, etc., and the realized revaluations, is substantially higher. We use customized benchmarks for monitoring that, and we are performing in accordance with those customized benchmarks. Your second question was whether we would expect a more defensive approach with respect to reinvesting. Well, what I try to explain is that the challenge in our investment policy is to keep the running yield as high as possible within the preconditioning of maintaining the risk profile of the portfolio constant. And what you can see is that we reduced the exposure to equities on the one hand. We kept the real estate portfolio stable. There were no new investments in commercial real estate. But on the other hand, we took use of the illiquidity premiums. And that is what we are doing in the fixed income portfolio. And that is why we are increasing the share to residential mortgages. So when you ask, are you expecting a more defensive approach? No, not at this stage, as this approach is within the framework of the outcomes of our strategic asset allocation.
Okay, thank you. Maybe one thing to clarify, the 3.8, how does that compare with the new money yield for either Q2 or at the end of the quarter, please?
I don't have that figure available, but what you can imagine is when you look to the actual yields, where German bonds are, let's say, a level below 1%, and 30 years at 1.8, you can say that, we have done in the past relatively, as we are proud of that, a good job, in the sense that we were able to realize a relative stable and somewhat higher yield. And what we see, and maybe that's an indication, when you compare the running yield to the realization at, in 2013, we can see a decline of 0.2%.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if there are any additional questions, please press star one, star one. There are no further questions. Please continue.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if there are no further questions, I'd like then to close off this conference call. And I'd like to thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for the high quality and well thought through questions that you put forward to us. And as I said, I hope to meet all of you in person in the coming period. And I thank you very much for listening. And as said, at ASR, we are comfortable and proud with these first half year results, and look forward to meeting you in the coming period and at least a half year from now. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the ASR conference call. You may now disconnect your line. Thank you.